Okay, so this was the one of the requested topics was CRISPR gene editing and all related issues. I put sources here on CRISPR, on cloning, choosing the sex of a child. All those things are conceptually related, and how much we focus on the specifics is up to you. But these are all conceptually related. So this CRISPR, I gave you one diagram here, which Reicher Chiner had put on his source sheet when he taught this in Toronto. We did this at a Malava Malka once. Okay, what, anyone know what CRISPR is? Yeah, what's CRISPR? Good. So it's essentially a very, very advanced form of gene editing. That's basically the summary of it. It is the full name. It's clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats. That's what CRISPR stands for. I'm never going to say that again. I'm just going to say CRISPR. That would literally add like 20 minutes to the shiur. So this is really this is all the rage in genetics at the moment. There have been conferences recently in America trying to figure out ethical standards to control it. CRISPR has many, many potentials, right? Again, it's basically a form of gene editing. The way it works, as you see here, it's something that we learned, or actually adopted from viruses. And basically what happens, you can see here, right? Stage one is a cell is transfected with a DNA plasmid that expresses both the Cas9 protein, a sequence of guide RNA which matches that of the gene of interest. Step two is Cas9 identifies the corresponding DNA sequence on the host cell's genome and cuts both strands of DNA. The cell's attempt to repair the break effectively silences the targeted gene by joining the cleaved DNA back together using a process called non-homologous end joining. Or a faulty gene can be corrected with a replacement to make DNA, or a new gene altogether can be introduced. So basically what happens is that we've basically been able to take this process from a virus, we infect the person, and it breaks down the DNA. And when you break down the DNA, so it gives us the ability to, right, genes want to fix themselves. And what we've done with CRISPR is we're able to have, when the gene fixes itself with new genetic material. And what's wild about CRISPR is that the changes that we can affect are inheritable, right? You actually change the person, and therefore that gene will now be inherited. We've had certain sort of, you know, similar things in the past. At this point, in a lab that does CRISPR, the process costs a few thousand dollars, right? Which is not that much, right? And it is a quick process. So the reason CRISPR is such a big deal is because it allows us to change the genome quickly and with relatively little expense. And the opportunities for CRISPR are huge, right? Obviously, much of the research that has been invested into CRISPR, in humans at least, is the possibility of curing certain genetic diseases, right? Replacing problematic genes with healthy genes, and then inheriting that, whatever it might be. Sickle cell anemia, I think, is one of them that they've been researching. Certain cancerous, right?
HIV.
Yeah. Now, that's not the only thing it's used for. Much research has been done as well. If you go online, you just go into YouTube and put CRISPR or ethics of CRISPR, you'll get like three TED Talks in a row. And then you'll get, right, because those are the most watched, and then you'll get a few like hour and a half symposiums, which are fascinating if you have the time to watch them. Every time I give any share like this, I just sort of go back through a few of these. So yesterday, I just listened to several hours worth of this, and it's fascinating every time. Some of the other research they're doing is what is the, right, number one killer of children in the world? Malaria, thank you. Malaria. So what they're doing, one of the experiments they're trying to do is to rewire the genetics of mosquitoes so they won't be attracted to humans to basically solve the malaria problems.
Oh my God, that's the best.
Yes, that is... Yes, exactly.
Oh,
but this is not primarily for like the bugging, but for like in the colloquial, but to prevent malaria deaths. They're using it in agriculture because of the predicted food shortages in the coming decades. People in agricultural sciences are working on using CRISPR to develop more vegetables and fruit and grains that are let's say. Yes, exactly. That are climate dependent, right? To take something which normally can only, you know, grow in warm temperature and make it that it can grow in cold temperature and the like, to allow growing food in places that currently are not amenable to agriculture. So CRISPR is being used in not just in humans, but to help humanity through in all these different ways. And like I said, because it's relatively cheap and really quite quick, it is the most promising science science. And right, you see some of these at the bottom here, right? That it's being used, it can be used for food and livestock modification, for gene driver. This is the malaria issue, for gene therapy, for diseases. The biggest concern, however, that's really plaguing the scientific community, right? What is the biggest ethical concern, right? What are they worried about?
Maybe change things too much.
So one is just changing things too much, which. There's a pragmatic reason for that, which is simply we don't 100% know what is going to happen with this. Like, we know that it's promising, but there's often unintended consequences. Yeah, what else? Yeah.
I'm like, sort of in a way, stepping about you as human. Like, how much should people, how much power do you
Good. So one of the, as we'll see, the main halachic discussion, which again is more of a meta halachic discussion, is what poskim have become worried about, which is called the playing God problem. And there is some talk of that in the scientific community, right? Which is, have we gone too far? Right? You find this more in religious communities who think that there's a problem, right? That humans should be limited. But there is in the secular literature also a bit of a discussion of this right? Have we gone too far? There's also the main problem that they talk about, though, beyond the practical problem, the main ethical problem that concerns them is what they've called the designer baby problem, or that's the nice way of putting it, or eugenics in the less nice way of saying that, meaning we can all sort of agree that if we can get rid of cancer, then that's a good thing, whatever the case may be. But the same science can theoretically be used to make someone a better athlete or a better musician, or give them blue eyes if that's what they want, or right, tall, whatever, right? And this is something that scientists are really worried about. Ethicists are really worried about for many reasons. The problematic but less problematic side of this equation, they're worried about entrenching wealth gaps, right? Because let's say it'll cost, I don't know, $1 million to make a designer baby, right? So then people who don't have $1 million will be normal human beings, and people who have $1 million to spare on their child will make sure that their kid has an IQ of 220 and has perfect, right, as, you know, as we... Oh, sorry, I should have noted one point. One of the other things that makes CRISPR so powerful isn't just its ease, but it was the finishing of the Human Genome Project. But that should have been obvious, right? Meaning the fact that we can map the human genome is what allows us to, in any way, right, for this to be effective, yeah.
But, I mean, for what I know, anyway, we don't
We may be able to phenotypically change humans, like change, alter their appearance, like that's where the designer baby comes in. Are we really at a point where we can say, like, oh, we can alter this gene and they'll be a better athlete because of it? Like,
No. We're not there yet. Right. What we're worried about, right? What scientists are worried about is that as we improve this technology, which is already impressive,
because that's
right?
That's nature versus nurture. Like,
oh, correct. Right. No, we haven't gotten there yet. We don't know what we will be able to do. Right. We're worried about, right, is that we'll be able to do this, right, and that the result will be, right, so again, at the relatively mild side of this, they're worried about entrenching wealth gaps, in that sense, right, or privilege gaps or whatever, right, meaning the people who are wealthy and have access, whatever, will just, right, entrench that in their children because they'll make them smarter and stronger and, right, whatever. We don't know exactly what we'll be able to do, right, whether we'll ever be able to map exactly. Right, we don't know what we'll be able to do. We aren't there yet. Right, we aren't there yet. In halacha, this is actually something we talk about a lot, which is why we actually have a lot of sources on this. But in common philosophical discussion, is just called the slippery slope argument. Right, is that we're worried about what this will lead to when we have the technology, and what will happen when it gets into the wrong hands. Right, I mean, you know, you watch these panels, and inevitably someone will ask, well, will the government be able to create, right, super soldiers? Right, people have been watching too many movies, but that is the concern, right? That we'll be able to do that. In theory, we could, right? In theory, right? This technology could lead to something like that. In theory, again, it would take time. It would take figuring out exactly how to do it. But we don't know exactly where it's going. That's why this is a slippery slope argument, right? That's the question, right? It was the fourth panel that came up when I just YouTubed CRISPR ethics or something like that. If you watch that one, I forget which one it was, but they're all versions of them, similar points. They point out that this is not just theoretical, right? The earlier version of this discussion, as we'll see, I put towards the end, which is one I've sort of focused on more because it's the same principles, was about choosing the sex of a child. And there we know that... in sort of low-tech ways, right? China is a good example of how bad this can go, which is in a type of eugenics, right? Where once you are going to start to control, you will often control for just males in certain societies, and that leads to problems, significant problems, and not just that chauvinistic, right? Which it is, but it leads to even bigger problems because right now, right? First of all, I think the number they threw out was that it led to the non-birth of 44 million children. I assume they mean not like just people didn't, right, like try to have children. I mean like children who were aborted and things like that. There are also terrible, terrible, terrible repercussions on the social structure. If anyone watches John Oliver, so like 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, something like that, he had a piece on Last Week Tonight. Yes, some people watch it. It's late night, you know. Anyways, political comments. Anyways, on the one-child policy, we noted that there are, I forget how many tens of millions of men just mathematically speaking, cannot get married because there's such a weight of men over women in the society, which therefore entrenches the procreation problem to a second generation. Right, because now they can't have children, which means that there's financial problems because now one within 10 years or something, one child will be responsible for his parents and grandparents on both sides because there's no one else. Right, it's a financial model. The society has built a financial model where kids take care of their parents, but there are no kids to take care of the parents. Right, so that will lead to potential financial collapse. It leads to sex slavery because people want to get married, so they basically kidnap women from other countries. And they found in one province alone, they found, I think the number was like 13,000 kidnapped women just from Myanmar. So these things have real consequences. So that's the type of thing they're worried about times a million, right? Once you deal with potential CRISPR. So the practical concerns of, right, what will we miss, right? What will we miss scientifically? The ethical concerns, the playing God concerns, the slippery slope arguments, right? Will this lead to eugenics, right? This is what the community is worried about. So on the one hand, what you have is this, right, the amazing potential, life-saving potential of CRISPR in terms of what it can do in agriculture and animals, and directly in terms of helping helping with disease. On the other hand, you have these, you know, ethical and practical nightmares that come from it. And this is why CRISPR has been talked about as much as it has. Again, I find this fascinating for many reasons. First of all, I think it's objectively fascinating. You know, my mother has an obsession with genetics before she... My mother stayed in the end of the day in epidemiology, but for the sort of beginning of a career, entertained going into genetics. So since I was like very young, I think I went to like my first like genetics lab when I was like 7 or something like that. I don't remember. So I do have an interest in, and you know, then we get to, you know, like discuss this over table because my sister-in-law is now in the middle of a doctorate in genetics at Hebrew U. But that's what we're talking about, okay? Right? That is essentially what we're talking about in CRISPR. And like I said, some of the conversations that you'll find about CRISPR are basically repeats in just enhanced form of the discussions that you had when it became possible to choose the sex of a child. I'm debating what the best way of doing this is. Maybe, yeah, you know what? Maybe let me sort of outline the science there, so you'll understand why these were conceptually similar, and then we'll get into the halachic issues. Cloning was another sort of topic that was similar, but let me talk about the choosing the sex of the child, because that I think was actually a bit of a... This is on... I separated the topic, so if you look on... I don't know what page it is, but I put the three sort of sources together. Choosing the child sex, it's a few pages in. Like I said, it was an earlier version of this. Now, that meant a lot of different things. I gave you a summary here, there were low-tech methods that were used, which was basically simply like changing diet, changing sexual positions, changing the timing of intercourse in terms of ovulation, which can mildly affect which sex is likely to be conceived. But the effectiveness is questionable, right? The numbers range. Not so much. Some of them are low as like 55, 56%, which, as you know, is not much more than chance. Then there was the Erickson method. The Erickson method is essentially you use a centrifuge to separate sperm into fast swimmer and slow swimmer. Fast swimmer is those that will conceive a male. Slow swimmer a female, and you do that in a test tube, and then you use artificial insemination, intrauterine insemination (IUI) to conceive the child that way. That has a better success rate. The numbers range between 73% to 85% success, and then obviously with IVF you have 100%. Success if you, right, conceive the child, right, in vitro, and then you choose to put a particular sex back in the womb, right, you have 100% success rate. You do that using, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis and screening, right, to figure it out. And that obviously has 100% success rate. That's the one that is the most controversial. It's also the one that's most complicated. It's $20,000 or so. In America, in Israel, it's free. In Israel, the government will pay for 2 successful rounds of IVF. Right? The insurance will cover successful rounds, which is a lot. Right? In America, it is $20,000 an attempt. In Israel, the first 2 successful children born of IVF is covered by medical insurance. That is a significant difference in policy between the two countries. That one, just to give you an idea of what was going on there, you had the same type of discussion. Why were people choosing the sex of their child? So there were medical reasons, right? There are certain diseases which are carried along, let's say, the Y chromosome. And therefore, if people knew that they were carriers, sometimes they only wanted girls, right? So that they would be less likely to, or right, they just wouldn't carry a disease, right? So again, just like with the CRISPR, you had medical reasons for this. You had the problematic simply preference issues, though middle cases, right? You had people who just only wanted boys, but you also have cases like people already have 5 boys and want a girl, or vice versa, or something like that. In Israel, when this was brought up, you had the people who simply wanted to fulfill their mitzvah of puravu and have a boy and a girl, right? If they had, right, there was a rabbi in Alon Shvut, the rabbi of the shul, had 7 girls in a row, and then he had twins, and they were both girls, right? So you have families like that, and right, at some point, like, if you, right, you want, not just preference, like, there's a mitzvah of a boy and a girl, and at that point, you know, you might want to have a girl. In Israel, there was a particularly unique manifestation of this. There was, and this was actually how it entered into law in Israel, was a Kohen was impotent, and him and his wife wanted to have a child through donor sperm, and the husband requested that the children only be female. Why? Well, it wasn't just that they can't be coins anyways. It was that he didn't want the shame that because in Israel you duchen every morning, right, that he would go up and his son wouldn't every day, right? He didn't want that, right? Because the child, it was donor sperm, right? It was donor sperm. He was impotent, right? So he didn't want it to be that his son, right, because halachically the son would not be his. It's not his sperm, right? We get it, leaving aside the machloket about whether a child from your own sperm conceived through IVF, whether you right, what the implications are there, right? This was donor, there's no question. This was not his child halachically, or biologically, or in pretty much any sense, except that he was raising the child, right, with his wife, and it was his wife's child. He didn't want a boy, because he didn't want that. And this was actually the case, like I said, that entered it into Israeli legal discussion. And again, in that case, you had the same type of disputes, right? Are we playing God? What are, right, slippery slope? What could be the consequences of this, right? The same type of issues that you saw Poskim struggling with. So this was an early version, shall we say, of the CRISPR discussion. And just to give you an idea of how complicated, even on that issue, which was much less expansive than CRISPR, how different, how vast the conclusions you could reach were. In America, does anyone know what the law is about choosing the sex of the child? Are you allowed to?
No.
Yes, you can. It is completely legal in America. There is no problem. You are allowed to choose the sex of your child. Any Canadians? Canadians? Anyone want to know what the law is in Canada? Right? These are two similar cultures, right? Right next door to each other, right, etc. What?
It's an eh.
Yeah. So what's the law in Canada?
You can't.
Yes, if you choose the sex of your child, it carries with it on paper up to a 10-year prison sentence and $500,000 fine. Right? The difference between these two, right, is vast, right? And there was a doctor who wrote an article a few years ago when I was living in Canada, actually. And he said, I don't understand, the Canadian policy is insane because Canada happens to have a very, very loose abortion policy. And therefore, according to the law in Canada, just the way it worked out was that it was legal to, and there's no limitations on why you can abort, right? Definitely in the early stages. So it was legal in Canada to conceive a child, discover it was, let's say, a boy, and abort the boy, but it was not legal, right, carried with a 10-year prison sentence to do IVF and choose the boy over, right, the girl over the boy, whatever, I forget which order I just did that in, right, the girl over the boy over the girl, whatever. In advance, he said, it's crazy, right? These are not, right? These two laws don't make sense together. How did Canada get to such a weird legal place? Because this is a complicated ethical issue, right? It's a bit, right? It's a lot of slippery, slow concerns. And when the abortion laws were crafted, they didn't take this into concern. When the laws about this were constructed, they did. And therefore, you have these contradictory laws. They are contradictory. But the point is that it was messy, and when the laws were constructed, it came to different things. So, with all of this as background, right, let's try to understand halachically, right, or Torah ethically, let's say, as we'll see, what does Allah have to say about all these issues? When I gave a course on this in Toronto, I called it Playing God, right? And I just did, right? I did choosing the sex of your child, I did cloning, GMO, right? These are all sort of conceptually, ethically related questions. What does Halakha have to say? So, how do you want to do this? I can point you to some makaras and we can do some chavrusa time, or in this particular one, we could work it out together, right? We could just go through it and discuss the issues and go through Makarot. It is okay. So let's do that. This is a complicated issue. Okay. So, okay. So let's start with the first set of cases. Okay. Do you want to start with CRISPR? Right.
CRISPR.
We'll start with CRISPR. Okay. So let's start with CRISPR. Okay. So let's take the medical cases, right? Let's say you're using CRISPR to heal a person or heal their children or whatever, right? What do you think? Is that halakhically problematic, ethically problematic? What do you think?
Should be fine,
right? Why should it be fine?
Because you want the person to survive.
Yeah, you want the person to survive, and even if it's not survival, let's say it's improve the quality of life vastly. Why is that okay? What category do we have in halacha? So, right, if the person will die, we have pikuach nefesh. Even if it's not pikuach nefesh, what category do we have? Refuah. Right, and I just gave you one source, right? This is pretty clear. Number two, the Gemara in Bava Kamma tells you the context is the laws around battery, assault and battery, right? If someone damages somebody else, so then they are obligated to pay what? Right, the five payments, nezek, which is right the loss to the body, tsar, right, pain, shevet, which is loss of work, ripui, which is medical expenses, and boshet, which is humiliation that was incurred. And in that context, the Gemara says, well, from the fact that we know that a doctor, right, that you have to pay medical expenses, what does that tell you? That it is permitted for a doctor to heal, right? Meaning this is a category that halacha recognizes. So basically all the poskim assume, and this is true for the most part in CRISPR, this is true in the choosing the sex of the child issue, this is true in much of the modern ethical discourse, policy discourse. There is an assumption that if we're using these technologies just for medical purposes to cure a disease, so then, it doesn't pose any ethical problem, it doesn't pose any halachic problem. What is the one problem it does pose? The slippery slope issue, right? You can't, right, that still exists, right? You always, in the back of your mind, have to still construct policy, even if this particular case is legitimate, the reason that, and again, if you watch these TED Talks, you'll see most of the presenters are actually scientists who are revolutionary in the CRISPR sort of right field, who are actively asking for controls to be put on it, because they said we understand the potential of what we're doing, we think it's valuable, but we also know the danger, and that's why we have to sit down, right, scientists and policymakers and ethicists, and we have to construct a policy, because even if you're doing it for the right reasons, it might get into the wrong hands, it might be done for the wrong reasons, but fundamentally there's nothing wrong about, right, the refuah issue, right? If it's done for, intrinsically, if it's done for medical purposes, the assumption in poskim and in ethicists is that this is okay. The problem is that for the most part, what we're not dealing with is, right, we're dealing with concerns about non-medical issues. What makes it tricky is that we are not really dealing with hard and fast halachic issues. Why aren't we dealing with hard and fast halachic issues? So basically because no one has ever, right? For the most part, people never thought about these issues 1,000 years ago for obvious reasons, right? Who could have imagined this? This was sci-fi. At right? Or beyond the realms of possibility. Now, therefore, the methodological issue becomes as follows. Basically, all the issues that we'll see, not all of them, but most of them, or at least many of them, are, shall we say, value concerns, right? Rather than straight halachic concerns. The question, therefore, that faced Poskim is how do we deal with things that are not formally problematic, or it's hard to pin down a formal prohibition, but are subject to Torah and general ethical problems. So there is a general methodological assumption of some poskim, which I gave you here in 3 and 4, where the Mishnah in Yodayim says, Amar Yishmael, Elazar ben Azariah, Alecha raya lelameid, Jadam machmer, Shekol machmer, Alav raya lelameid. At some point, there's a conversation in the Mishnah, and Rabbi Yishmael says to Elazar ben Azariah, he says, listen, you want to be machmir, you want to be stringent, you have to prove it. Because anyone who wants to be stringent has to prove that it's prohibited. And the Tiferet Yisrael, there are comments that Shekol davar shelo neida tam leasro, anything where we don't know why it is prohibited, mutar hi bili ta'am. It is permitted, it is assumed permitted. Because the Torah doesn't list everything which is not prohibited. There are certain things which are prohibited, and other things are presumed permitted. So one could come to this topic and simply say, look, it's hard to pin down a prohibition, and therefore it is just permitted. Yeah.
But how could this be true if we have like chukim, which are like...
So those are cases where the Torah said so, but if the Torah didn't say so... Right?
But we didn't have a reason for it.
So it's not a reason, meaning if you don't have evidence, right? It's not about a reason as much as it's evidence. If you don't have evidence, right, you have to assume that it's permitted. Now, we have to be careful, though. Because first of all, we know that not everyone, as much as this is Tiferet Yisrael, there are poskim, especially in the modern period, who their tendency is the opposite.
Yeah.
Right? Right? Their tendency is the opposite, right? In Anthony Manning's sources, he spends a few pages on this, right? There is this other trend in poskim, the Chassam Sofer, right, who came up with the phrase Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, reappropriated a phrase from the Mishnah to mean that anything that's new is just prohibited by virtue of the fact that it's new, which again was more of a policy statement than a halachic one. But yes, there is a conservative impulse that. Small C, conservative impulse, that opposes this sort of programmatic statement of the Mishnah. But the way Reicher Chiner put it in Toronto, I think he's right, and this is a fair summary of the issues, though I did not give you all his sources, and I gave you some of my own, but I think his framing is correct, is that the real question here is not, is this formally prohibited? And do we assume that things are prohibited when we don't have evidence for it, or do we, right, do we take a conservative approach, do we not take a conservative approach? The real question here is that this is not, right, it's one thing to say something is morally neutral, and therefore, if we don't have reason to believe that it is prohibited, we'll assume that it is permitted. It's another thing to say that we actually have strong ethical intuitions about potential issues here, but we're going to ignore them because I can't find a formal prohibition. The real question that poskim are grappling with is the same question that ethicists are grappling with a tweak. Right? Ethicists are grappling with, what are the moral problems here? Poskim have to deal with the question of, what is the weight of potential moral issues on when there isn't necessarily a halachic issue that can be pinned down, right? That is really sort of the meta question that is going on. I gave you just two of the sources that he put here as to the halachic weight of Jewish values. So he gave a quote from Rav Lichtenstein, from Mori Barabi of Aaron Lichtenstein, who wrote as follows. He says, surely in relating to halacha, including those areas which one may find morally difficult, there is some role for conscience, some role for the goodness in us, particularly in an interpretive capacity. Conscience does and legitimately can have a role in helping us to understand the content and substance of the tzav. So the first point is that, yes, there is room for simple moral argumentation within halakha. Does it mean it's usher? Not necessarily. But that doesn't mean it's morally neutral either. The Rambam has a helpful point in Parash Mishnayot where he says if you want to fully categorize all actions in life, there are not three categories, there are five. It's right, there is what he calls, right, there's mitzvah, then there's, right, there's the three obvious, right, obligated, neutral, and permitted, and prohibited, and then there is, right, the morally ugly and the morally commendable, right, which are in between, right, there's obligated and, like, good thing to do, neutral, bad thing to do, prohibited, right, really in life, right, that is the, and the things that are in these categories, right, the, it's nice to do, or it's not nice to do, but it's not necessarily prohibited, have weight, if not as strong as these two, right, obligated and prohibited, but they obviously have weight and must be dealt with, yeah.
But doesn't Disney also believe there's an ethic outside of halakha? So, like, it's sort of like...
Yes, those are some of the quotes that I sort of did not put on here. Yes, Rav Lichtenstein argues that there is an ethic outside of halakha, or more precisely, he argues that there is an ethic outside of law, and whether you consider halakha just the law or the law plus the ethics that are inherent in it is a taxonomy question, but not a fundamental question, in the sense that obviously there are values beyond the letter of the law. Yes. The best summary of that really is the Ramban, or this piece in Magen Mishnah summarizing it, which is to know that even within the halakha itself, there are meta mitzvot that tell you that you have to take into account not just sort of the letter, but the spirit of the law. The Ramban has three of these, right? Where does the Ramban argue that our obligations extend beyond the letter of the law to the spirit? Anyone know? So he has two main ones that are much more famous. One is Kedoshim to you. And the other is Vasita Yashar Batov. But Kedoshim to you, the Ramban says, that it's not enough to keep the whole Torah, because then you could be what it's called a Naval Birshut HaTorah, right? A degenerate within the bounds of the permissions of the Torah. And there he says, for example, right, the Torah says you can't eat not kosher. It doesn't technically say you can't be a glutton, right? It says that you can't curse, in the sense like a blasphemy or curse somebody. Doesn't say you can't use vulgar language, but the fact that the Torah controls, puts certain controls on the appetitive desires, or right, speech or sexual desires, indicates that the Torah wants you to act in a certain way. In Ben Adam L'Chaveiro, he calls it, and this is what I gave you here from the Magen Mishnah, V'chein Amrav, Asita Yashar Batov. In the context of moral issues, the Torah, and interpersonal issues, the Torah says, you shall do the right and the good. The intent is that you should act in a way which is good and right with people. And the Ramban continues, again, this is a summary of the Ramban, he says, the Torah didn't want to give you a laundry list of details. Because the Torah is forever at all times. He said, times change. It's impossible. The Torah would have gone on forever if you tried to have a laundry list of everything that will ever be problematic in the history of the world in the future. It just can't happen. And therefore, what did the Torah do instead? Right? What is the model of the Torah? So, the way Ray Liebtag once explained the Ramban, I think it's correct. Ray Liebtag said the Ramban's theory of the Torah is essentially that of a connect the dots picture. Right? Remember those? Remember those? Connect the dots? My kids do them now. I assume you haven't done those in years. Right? But what's the logic of a connect the dots picture? Is that there is a picture that emerges if you, right, connect, right, the explicit points. And he says the Ramban's theory is that essentially the Torah are, right, the mitzvot and the, right, both positive and negative are the points. Vashiter Yashar V'Tov and Kedoshim to you tells you that there is a picture that is supposed to emerge when you connect those points, and the spirit of the law is telling you that you're supposed to live your life in line with the picture that emerges and not just the points that are plotted. Right? That's essentially the image of the Ramban. And therefore, it is undeniable that there is weight. Now, I'm using a vague term on purpose. There is weight to values, to both sort of general ethical values and intuitions, as well as what I would call emergent values, right? Values that emerge from the ethic of the halachic system, right? Not necessarily intuitive ones, but ones that on a second look at the Torah emerge from the totality of the Torah, and that they have weight, right? They have weight, not necessarily the same way that a prohibition does, right? But they are in this realm, right? Things where halacha has something to say, even if it's not going to say, you know, obligated, prohibited, but halacha has something to say. And therefore, the best way of getting a Jewish, halachic, ethical perspective on these issues is to ask, well, what are the concerns, right? What are the concerns, and what might halacha point to? What directions might it point to? So, let's go through some of them, right? So, right, Turchiner had said the first one he's worried about is, right, what he put is beautification, right? He said, one of the things that you hear a lot in these ethical conversations is designer babies, right? But before we even get into the playing God problem, right, meaning is using this technology to create designer babies ethically problematic, there's an assumption here. That is what?
It's for
therapy. And then that's bad, right? Meaning when people say, right, in one of these lectures that I was listening, the scientist said, he said, listen, imagine that in 30 years, right, your child is at the park with their child, and you know your grandchild is not a CRISPR edited child. So your child, right? So your grandchild is there and has snot running down his nose because that's what kids do, right? And you know. Runs, you know, moderately fast, and like, I don't know, right? Their hair is just sort of goes out in all directions, and right? And next to your grandchild on the swing is, right, a child that never has a cold, right? And is, right, runs several miles an hour faster than your child, right? And it always has perfect hair and perfect eyes, right? Is that fair? Is that the world you want to live in? Right? They have this whole. Right, everyone has their own way of imagining this.
Does that happen sometimes?
Does it have to do that? I know it does happen, but you know, it'd be exacerbated, right? Now the assumption of that question is that were it only for these aesthetic things or right relatively superficial things. If that was the reason people were using this technology, that would be wrong, right? There's an assumption there. Is that obvious? Right? Right? I sort of added levels to it, which is it wrong not just to pursue those things, but pursue them knowing that this is going to be the realm of the wealthy, right? And it entrenches differences, right? That's an added problem. But let's say you had two people who had the same, right, who had the same monetary capabilities. And the question was, is it just right or wrong to pursue, right, to use this technology for, right, for beauty? Is that a problem, right? Meaning, if it weren't CRISPR, would that be a problem, right? That's really the question you have to ask, right? Is to know whether it's wrong to use this technology to create more beautiful children, right? You have to ask, is that pursuit of beauty through medical, right, through medical means, a problem? What's the answer?
I mean, it's ambiguous.
Yeah, right, exactly. That already, right, there's an assumption there, which is not clear. There are certain post-skim who have very strong intuitions that would be wrong. So, for example, you look at number 7 here. This is Eliezer Waldenberg and the Tzitz Eliezer in his tshuva about plastic surgery. Right, which is a conceptually similar model. Why is it conceptually similar? Because the question he was essentially asking was, look, surgery is always dangerous, but we allow surgery for legitimate medical reasons. Is the pursuit of beauty a legitimate enough reason to allow a person to enter into risk. Right? That was essentially, right? So there's the nexus there between a formal halachic question, which is it legitimate to swallow risk? And a sort of values question, which is, obviously it is sometimes, but is the pursuit of beauty a legitimate reason? Yes?
I mean, elective surgeries have a pretty well-defined level of risk, and it's, like, you can argue that it's, like, more or less than, like, getting into your car in the morning to drive to work.
Correct. But, and that is found in the postcom. The postcom will say, look, you're right, it's dangerous to go to work, right, to get into your car, right, that's why, right, New York City has something like, someone told me the statistics are, on average, a 3-year higher lifespan than the rest of the country because people who live in the city drive, right, significantly less on average than most people, right? And most people between the ages of 18 and 49, right, if they die, the most likely reason for them to die is a car accident, and therefore people who live in cities where they have good public transportation die less, right? Just statistically speaking, right? It's true, right? These are just, right, you can't argue with that, right? But why do people drive? So people drive because they need to get to work. They need to whatever, right? That would legitimate the risk, right? Essentially, the question, right? Because the question always in risky situations is, with any level of risk, is does the need warrant the risk? So living your life, going to work, etc., warrants that risk. What about elective surgery? So again, this is a case where it's a good example where there was a certain nexus of a formal halachic question, which is, how much risk can you swallow? The answer being, well, you're allowed to swallow risk if the reason is legitimate. And the Tzitzeliezer are saying, well, therefore the answer to this halachic question is essentially a values question. Yeah?
I'm just like thinking, would this be categorized, like, let's say someone wants to have elective surgery for their, like, and their mental health will improve after their...
Good. So hold that thought for a second. Let's see an extreme, and then we'll take that point and reintegrate it. So an example of someone who really thought that this entire pursuit of beauty was not valid, and therefore halachically, whenever it comes up in a halachic conversation, that should be our starting point. That pursuit of beauty is bad, and therefore whatever implications flow from that should follow. So if you look at this tshuva, he writes, "V'ach miguchachu lavo ulahatzia lahatir nituach kanzel l'nashim begibuv kolot." He said, it is ridiculous to suggest, to permit such surgery for women by amassing leniencies for various midrashim which praise women's beauty. Or really, yeah. It's not even worth responding because there's no place at all. He said, "Varak ba'ofen militzi." Right? If I had to respond homiletically, I would say, "Yesh la'ashiv al zeh b'divrei Shlomo ha'melech alav ha'shalom shehitif b'ruach Hashem asher b'kirbo v'amar sheker achin v'hevel ha'yofi isha yirat Hashem yititalal." Right? As a ethical point, I would say, "Look, Shlomo ha'melech said that beauty is vain." Right, charm is false, beauty is vain. A woman who reveres God is to be praised. Right, anyone with reverence for God in her heart would not stray after such fads of plastic surgery for aesthetics alone, most of which is just for appearance and whims of human beings, no two of whom were created to look alike. He said, if we shouldn't even trouble God to alter nature in this way, building on a Gemara about an ugly person who someone called him ugly, so he said, well, if you have a problem, take it up with my maker. He said, if even God, we don't ask, right, make people who are ugly, make them beautiful, then obviously we shouldn't play God to do this. Now you see, right, he's sort of blurring those ethical problems, right, that playing God problem with the fact that he doesn't want you to play God for this purpose, right? Right, well, he's saying, right, even God wouldn't do it, right? God created and that's it, creation is done. So, On the one hand, you could say, well, yeah, right? A posek like the Tzitzel-Yezer is going to tell you, look, I'm never willing to swallow these medical procedures if the pursuit is beauty. On the other hand, yeah. Good, right? On the other hand, you'd say, first of all, that's very nice, but that doesn't mean beauty is meaningless, right? And if you look at the next two sources, right, we have these Gemaras who actually, right, praise the Imaot for having been beauty in somewhat interesting and maybe not modern politically correct ways, right? That Hakol b'fnei Sarah kekof, everyone compared to Sarah was like a monkey in terms of their beauty. B'fnei Chava kekof, right? Sarah compared to Chava, right? Goes on.
That's really offensive.
Yeah, well, I didn't come up with the Gemara.
That's so mean.
What? Anyways, next time I'll leave out that Gemara. What do you want? And the Gra in number 9. Notes that Sheker Achen Ve'Aval Yofi Shahiran Hashem Hiti Talal, the way that Tzitzel-Yezer is reading it is that beauty is unimportant, the only thing that matters is what's on the inside. The Gra said that's not really what it means.
It's not what's on the inside, it's outward, it's actions.
So our actions, right, he says, it's not just that, he says, no, it's just false to say that beauty doesn't matter. It does. And in fact, what he says is what it means is that if someone is actually a good person, the way he reads the pasuk is as follows. If someone's a bad person, then physically, right, the fact that they're physically appealing does not redeem them. But if someone is a good person, right, then there's nothing wrong with appreciating, you know, the non-moral good qualities about them also, right? Meaning, like, you wouldn't choose a spouse because you find them good-looking alone, you shouldn't, right, if they're a horrible person. But if someone is a good person, right? It's legitimate to be part of your calculus of, am I attracted to this person? Am I physically attracted to them? Right? Meaning, the way that Gra reads the pasuk is the opposite. Right? When beauty is coupled with moral turpitude, right? Then the beauty is meaningless. But we all recognize that there is value to beauty, to attraction, to aesthetics, right? It's just that it can't override other things. But if you take that perspective, so then, is the pursuit of beauty per se bad? Not really, right? I mean, it's bad if it becomes a replacement for important things. But what the Gra is telling you is that beauty is actually an important thing as well. And in the context of plastic surgery, Moshe Feinstein basically made this argument. He said, look, right? Beauty isn't just, it's just not vanity, right? He said, look, why do people get plastic surgery? So sometimes it's just because they're vain. They want to look more beautiful. But sometimes it's because they legitimately feel like they're, right, they're ugly. They feel like they need it for whatever, for, right, to increase their chances of getting married. He said, look, I'm not saying you have to do it, right, right? But if someone comes to me and says that they have they really need this for their psychological well-being, whatever, they really believe this is what they need, and I'm not going to say it's us, sir, right? That's legitimate, too. To want to look beautiful is legitimate, right? And therefore, Moshe Feinstein says, yeah, like, it is permitted, right? Like, if someone says, look, I'm happy the way I am, then good for them, right? That's great, but not everybody's like that, and we know, right, that certain people, right, meaning, right, body image issues is a real issue in some people, right? This is really what's going to make them more confident. It's not just that it'll give them physical beauty, right? The increase in physical beauty will help them, right, with their body image and therefore their confidence and everything, right? These things are complicated, and it's not obvious that the pursuit of beauty per se is negative. So this is the first sort of level that you'd have to ask, which is, is that, right, concern that people will start using this for purely aesthetic purposes, how bad is that really, right? You could have an intuition that this is really, really bad, or you could say, look, you know, it's not per se so bad. Now, when I haven't seen much in the halachic literature about this, But I keep bringing it up because I do think it is a real ethical concern. A lot of the concerns are not the way it's phrased here, right? Is the pursuit of beauty per se bad? Right, like I said, in the ethical literature, what you'll find is a lot more worry about access, right? Is entrenched, right? Is entrenching, is entrenching inequality, right? That's really what people are more worried about, right? They're not worried about, right, if it costs $5 and everybody could do it and everyone can make themselves look as, you know, beautiful as they want, so then people would say, okay, that's great, right? They're worried more that it's going, right, that the pursuit of certain superficial things are going to entrench inequality, and that I think is a more serious ethical question than simply, is this a concern that if everyone could access it, would it be bad? Yeah. Correct, and that's one of the ethical arguments that's made, right, in favor in general of universal health care and the like. Yes, right, meaning without weighing in on that, right, the same ethical questions are brought up there, right, meaning is it legitimate to, right, differentiate access to medical care, right? Now, if you were asking me, I would say that I think it's obvious that on the hierarchy of values, it is more important to ensure people have access to basic health care than to, right, enhancements of any sort, right? I think that's obvious, and therefore, right, they are different ethical questions. But when you look at the ethical literature, you'll see that there are unique concerns to CRISPR because, right, the beauty one is not really what they're worried about. I mean, they're worried a little bit about that, but they're worried more like intellect. Right? Right? They're worried about things like that. And there, I think it's hard to say that the Torah doesn't approve of seeking wisdom, right? If we could improve our intelligence, right, in natural ways, right? The Gemara talks about this, right? The medical science of the time, the Gemara believed that eating olives was bad for your memory and eating olive oil was good for your memory. And therefore said if one wants to be wise, they should consume olive oil, right? Again, their science may have been off, right? But the point is that the Gemara does recognize that...
They would just drink a bunch of olive oil. Oh, it's really sad.
So that's actually... Ad Hayom, that is like in Arab society, that's actually normal. Not drink it, but to actually have like a tablespoon or something of olive oil every day. And to be fair, it has its medical... It is in fact proven to be medically beneficial. I'm just not sure about the olives versus olive oil, because pretty much the same things that you'll get from olive oil, you'll get from enough olives as well. okay. like I said, the main sort of meta-halachic concern that people are really worried about is this playing God thing. This is what Poskim really get worked up about. And it basically comes down to the following. Two sources, right? This is where all the literature comes down to, and I can't say I find it compelling, but let me tell you what it is. The Ramban, in his discussion of Kilayim, right, all the various prohibitions of crossbreeding, says, why is it prohibited? So he says the following, in number 10. Hamarkiv shnei minin, mishaneh umakhish b'maseh breishit, Kiilu yachshov shelo yishlim hakadosh baruch hu ba'olamo kol atzorech v'yachbotu la'azor b'vriyato shel olam lo'osif lo briyot. One who grafts two species changes and contradicts creation as though he thinks that God did not complete his world with every need and he wishes to aid the creation of the world by adding creatures. And the Chinuch says the same thing is the rationale for the prohibition against magic. So let me just finish my thought and I'll take your question. Many of the poskim who oppose all these types of things look at this and say, look, you see that there's a Torah value, or maybe they upgrade it to a prohibition of playing God. Good. What's the problem?
The ability would not have been put in this world for us to be able to do this if we, like...
Good, so let's list the problems, right? One is...
By nature of the fact that we have the ability to do it,
doesn't necessarily mean that God is supposed to do.
Good, right? So we have sources that say, right, that maybe, well, you know, okay, forget sources. Let's start with it. One is the ability might imply, right? Might imply. I just made up a symbol, right? Might imply, right? Right? Legitimacy. Right? A similar argument is going to be sources that imply, right? Right? That creativity is good. Right? That creativity, power over nature is good. Right? Local argument, which is, who said we even think this is a problem? Right? So, while some people really do think this, if you look at number 12, the current chief rabbi said, right, the moment medical science tries to take upon itself duties in areas which are not its responsibilities, such as shortening life, cloning, or creating life in a natural way, must set down borders in order not to harm the Jewish basic belief that there is a creator of the universe in whose hands are life and death are placed. Right? Our poskim are going to take this. Other poskim say, I'm not so worried about it. So, for example, right, Rashi, Zeka. Yeah, I put this towards the end, but I'll just say it. Right, Rashi on the prohibition of kilayim says, why is kilayim prohibited? Why is it usher to crossbreed? Rashi says,
it's a chok,
meaning we don't know the reason. Now, if we don't know the reason, what can we not derive from it? That there's a problem playing God, right? Meaning you're assuming a particular interpretation, right? What else? Yeah.
They're also assuming that I'm looking at source 12, like that. When it says the medical scientist has duties in areas which are not its responsibility, he says those aren't their responsibility.
Say that again.
Oh, yeah.
Meaning who says it's not, right? Meaning maybe this is exactly. So some people will point to sources, let's say here, and we'll examine these more, but just to give you a quote, right? This is from Rai Soloveitchik. He writes, right?
Which one is a
chok? Kilayim. Right, yeah. Right? And therefore, right, if it's a chok, so then you don't have the Ramban's reason that the problem is playing God. Rai Soloveitchik developed basically a theology on the importance of being creative as follows, right? The Rav in who's read Lonely Man of Faith?
We're going to read it.
Okay, well, one of the things you'll see in it, so I won't ruin it for you completely, but I'll give you contours of an argument, is that the Rav argues that everything that's in the Torah, including narrative, must have normative implications. And he says, if the first thing that we learn about God is that he is a creator, and that we're created in the image of God, then the first thing that we have to learn is that human beings are called upon to be creative. And how does the Torah express it right at the beginning of the Torah? That we should conquer the world, right? Which means that the Torah actually celebrates this, right? V'chiv shuha, right? That you will, right, be able to conquer nature, right? That there's actually something about being creative, about being able to master nature, which is in fact an expression of God, of humanity's divinity. And therefore, this is actually something that should be celebrated rather than criticized, right? The quote I put here is, right, in Halachic Man, where he makes the point as well. Does it come up with Lonely Man of Faith? No, sorry, this is in Halachic Man. This is in Halachic Man's analysis of man. There are parts of Lonely Man of Faith that point in this direction. No, it's in both, in different versions. And he writes, the scriptural portion of the creation narrative is the legal portion, which are to be found basic, everlasting halachic principles. If the Torah then chose to relate to man the tale of creation, we may clearly derive one law from this manner of procedure, that man is obligated to engage in creation and the renewal of the cosmos. And in fact, in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, the Gemara talks about Amar Rava, Ibo Tzadikim Baru Alma. Tzadikim wanted to, they could create worlds. I don't know what that means. Don't ask me what that means. I have no idea. It's some mystical statement that I don't understand. But the point is that the Gemara is celebrating the possibility of creating worlds. Shenemar ki im rezichem ayu mavdilim b'neichem levein elokeichem. So, one way of pushing back on it is saying, look, there is no problem of playing God. Kilayim is just a chok.
You can push back on it even more by pointing to sources that celebrate our ability to create. There is another argument that Dr. Steinberg, right? Dr. Avram, anyone know who Rabbi Dr. Steinberg is? So he's one of the leading medical halachists in the world. He is both a tremendous Talmud Chacham. He wrote... Do you have the Encyclopedia of Medical of Jewish Medical Ethics?
Yes.
Yes, this? He wrote this. He is also a... I think it's pediatric neuro-oncologist or something like that. Forget exactly. He's a specialist at Shaarei Tzedek. He's not just, right, a doctor. He is like super spitz specialist, whatever. So he's a very impressive doctor and a very impressive Talmud Chacham. He's also the editor of the Micropedia Talmudit, which is the truncated version of the Encyclopedia Talmudit that's coming out. He's also the founding editor of Asya, which is the medical ethics journal. He notes that many of these issues are just not relevant because, according to Ramban, what does it mean to be like God? What does the Ramban say? When are you being like God? When you create a new species, right? He said, I'm not sure that this is true in these issues. He was talking about cloning, but he says people tried, right, Dr. Steinberg, right? This is the next source, right? I've moved into the cloning sources, but this is just a helpful point. And he says, I'm not sure that's true, right? Some people have tried to use the Ramban to prohibit cloning, but that doesn't make sense because... You're not creating anything new. You're working with the genetic material that you have. And that's not exactly true here, right? Here, maybe you'd say it's more similar to cloning. Maybe. To kilayim, right? Because you might be adding in foreign genetic material. But in one of these panels that I watched, someone actually asked one of the scientists and says, do you think there's a difference morally between introducing foreign genetic material and using genetic material, right, from within... Right, the species to, right, and just sort of using the non-sick parts of it, and said maybe, right, meaning we could distinguish between cases. Yeah.
So I think for the argument of like, are we playing God? I think that if we truly believe that God is omniscient and omnipotent, that it wouldn't be an issue. Because if God is all powerful and all knowing, then if God didn't want this to happen, then we wouldn't have the resources to make it happen, so we wouldn't have the intellectual resources.
Right, that is, yeah. Right, this, right? Now, by the way, in philosophy, we have a name for this argument and why it's a bad argument, which is the naturalistic fallacy, right? But this is similar to the naturalistic fallacy, right? Which is, if something's natural, then it must be good. If it's unnatural, it must be bad. Right? Or the more broad one is that it's the right, slipping from an is to an ought. Right? But I tend to agree with you that this is not actually such a fallacy, because pretty much any teleological argument is... To say that is necessarily implies an ought is a fallacy. To say that it is should be part of the evidence in terms of determining an ought is not a philosophical fallacy at all. And all teleological arguments, right, meaning arguments that try to define something's moral purpose based on what, right, it seems programmed to do, right, meaning Aristotle, let's say, right, all of Aristotle is essentially, right, a version of this, just slightly weaker. Right, it doesn't say that is always implies ought. It says that is, right, what is should be taken into account when determining ought. So I actually, this was, I think, two chapters in my undergraduate thesis, was arguing that teleological arguments are essentially a more refined version of is ought arguments, which are actually philosophically defensible. If you didn't catch the sort of technical philosophy talk, that's fine. But it happens to be that I am partial to this because I think that it is legitimate not to say that is always an implication of ought, but that is should be at least taken into account when determining what ought to be. And yes, if human beings have come to this point that and God is omniscient, right, we can add all types of theological language to it, then that may imply, right, that it's legitimate. Again, may, right, maybe, etc. I put maybes and all other things, right? To do that absolutely would be the naturalistic fallacy. which I'm not going to do. So yes, right? That's true, right? That would be a counter-argument to this. Now,
what's the fourth one?
Oh, yeah, the fourth one is that this was the Roy Steinberg point, which was, right, is this even, right, if you're dealing with, right, if you're not creating a new species, then maybe there is no, right, then maybe there's no problem, right, maybe even the Ramban would not think it's a problem, right, maybe the Ramban's point is you can't use this technology to create a centaur, I don't know, right, but,
a mule.
What? Yeah, that's another source that I didn't put in, but yes, in certain Midrashic versions, right, we celebrate the fact that mankind was given the ability to create a mule, which does seem to indicate a certain tension with this, right, where maybe it only applies where it applies and it doesn't apply where it doesn't apply, and etc.
But the whole idea that things can apply where they apply and not apply where they don't apply just proves that on any issue, there's times when it could be right and times when it could be wrong.
Yes.
You don't usually have a categorical answer.
Correct, correct.
Yeah,
that's the problem. So, right, Clapper has an excellent piece that he's written several times over the years in different versions, where he makes the point that he describes what he calls chokification, right?
Yeah.
Chokification is essentially the process by which we come to understand a law as a chok, right? And he argues that the danger of chokification is that, in general, we assume that the reason for mitzvot should indicate how we live our lives beyond the scope of that mitzvah, right? That's the power of a mishpat. By defining something as a chok, what we do psychologically or experientially, religiously, is that we say, we'll keep this, but it doesn't shed light on the rest of my religious life, right? Like, I am willing to accept that para aduma, right, its ashes will make me tahor, but that doesn't tell me anything else about my spiritual life except maybe the value of submission, right? But, like, it is not, because I don't understand it, it can't influence other things. Therefore, he argues that the process of treating something as a chok is the process of saying something is something I will keep, but not something that will influence my religious worldview. And the process of mishpatification is the process of saying, not only is this true, but this is something that I will allow to influence the rest of my life. What he argues is that these aren't necessarily set, right? While there are things that maybe the Gemara describes as a chok, realistically, there are things that we come to understand functionally as chukim, and things as mishpatim, and he notes that there is a cost to this, right? Meaning you have to understand, but the act of making something into a chok in your head is the act of saying, this is no longer a relative data point to constructing a holistic religious life. Right? There's a cost to that. The benefit sometimes is that laws that you really don't understand or really bother you ethically or whatever, by making it into a chok, you're able to make it that it only bothers you in its local thing and doesn't bother, right, doesn't shake the foundations of your faith. Right? So the process of making something a chok, right, of choosing to view it as a chok rather than a mishpat, has the detriment of making that it doesn't give you, it doesn't influence the rest of your religious life. It has the benefit of allowing you, when necessary, to, right, not shake your, right, the foundations of your belief because of something that really, really bothers you, because you can, right, and therefore he argues that it is somewhat of a dynamic process. In this case, you see that, right? If you chokify Shatnez, right, you go with Rashi, then suddenly we've lost the data point. Is there such a thing as playing God as a problem? Right? If you mishpatify it, right, you choose the Ramban path and you say this actually teaches us something, then suddenly it's a live, right, data point in our discussion of halachic values. But what you see here is also that's a choice. Right? Because there are two different traditions, whether there's a chok or mishpat, there is therefore a live argument of, even if we're going to bring in halachic values, is this a value that halacha even is worried about, the problem of playing God? Yeah.
Another thing is, if you
chokify
it, you're saying that you no longer want to try to understand it.
Correct, right? Which is also has religious costs.
A lot, because so all of halacha is based on, like, trying to, like, understand.
Well, no, there's understanding two meanings. There's understanding the what and understanding the why. You can say it's a chok and I will understand the details of the law, but I won't try to understand why and therefore extrapolate beyond. But yeah, meaning, you're cutting off the tamei mitzvot component. I mean, I'll just say in brackets, right, that he uses this to explain descriptively, but also as part of his argument, that this argument about chok and mishpat and where you do it becomes evident in conversations on a lot of the hot button issues in our community, right? Just, this is an important point, right? He says, right, when you see, right, like he says, around women's issues, you see this, right? Poskim who believe that women's role in Judaism should be expanded will take any limitation on what women can do in Judaism and chokify it and say, yeah, that's, you know, that's a gzeirat hakasuv, they can't be a queen, but that doesn't show anything about leadership, right? And that will allow them to say, right, the limitations are irrelevant. And the poskim was saying, no, that shows your whole worldview, will mishpatify it and say, right, no, the fact that dot, 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 dot indicates that there's a more, right, there's a bigger worldview here, right? He's not, and his point was, I'm not, right, not good or bad, but you see that this is what people do, right? Meaning, whatever side you come out on, right, you can see that that is the process people are going through, right? Is the people who say, I would like to expand it, there are certain data points that indicate limitations, right? You'll see post-Kim Chokify it, right? Say, okay, well, yeah, but that's just a data point, but it doesn't indicate anything about the wider view. If they mishpatify it, right, they're saying, no, 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 right? Now, often, right, not always, but often people who like chokifying, shall we say, women's issues and expanding roles, therefore, for women, right, will do the same by, let's say, issues of sexuality, right? Like, homosexuality is a chok, right? We keep it, but that doesn't tell us anything about, right? There's not an image of, right? There's not value a marriage statement. It's not, like, we're not going to go like the sort of Christian theologians and try to make a public case for the traditional view of marriage. We'll just sort of let it be, right? People who mishpatify that will say no, right? This is part of, right? We're not going to be shy about the limitations that halacha puts on marriage because we think it's part of a view of the world, right? These types of things come up over and over again. And at least realizing what it is that we're doing, right, in the way we argue is important because then we understand the other side also, right? What we're really arguing it is not just a local interpretation. What we're arguing about is, are these laws just true or are they, in fact, right, stand in for meta values and therefore will dictate a way of life or not, right? I don't want to sort of flesh that out. I want to throw that out for to think about. Okay. But what we've seen so far, right, is we've explored two values. We've noted that basically, right, it is hard to pin down halachic issues. Here, it does seem to be more meta. When it comes to medical purposes, as we said, both on the meta level and on the halachic level, it seems to be obviously permitted. When it is not for medical purposes, so then the question you have to ask, and as we saw in the plastic surgery case, there is a certain nexus between halacha and hashkafa, right? Because not everything is mutter when there's some danger involved. What's permitted is things that are legitimate. What's legitimate may take in sort of amorphous values, term in legitimacy, but we saw, is beauty and the pursuit thereof a legitimate value, right? Poskim have a strong intuition that it's not. Want to limit medical intervention when it's only for beauty. But other posts can say it's not true, right? This is something that's potentially legitimate. The main issue, as I said, that people bring up is this playing God issue, where they get it from the Ramban, right? When the Ramban says that that's the reason for Kilayim, but as we noted, reasons to push back on that and say it's not a problem to play God is, first of all, maybe it's only a chok. Right? Maybe this is one of those chokified laws, meaning it's just a law, but there is no problem to play God. And then there's the positive arguments. There are sources that say creativity is good, right? There's the reality that maybe the fact that God allowed us to get to this point should indicate some level of legitimacy, because he's omniscient. Why would he let us get here if we're just going to use it to bring about, you know, Armageddon, or whatever we're going to do? And the fact that maybe, as crazy as this technology is, maybe it's very specifically being God if you create a new species. But trying to improve existing species or even cloning or whatever, Maybe that is not a problem. Let's look at maybe a few sources that that push in the direction that this is actually okay. Right? We saw sort of a hashgafic source from the Rav, but let me throw some more out. Maybe not necessarily inside. The Meiri, right? The Meiri, who is 13th or 14th century Provence, right, writing quite a while ago, in Sanhedrin, in the middle of the magic discussions, has this very strange comment, and says as follows. He says, anything that is done through natural science is not prohibited for magic, because of magic. And he says, that's understandable. But then his next line is, and even if in the future we will be able to create people without the act of procreation, which is something that we already know is a possibility. Again, he's writing this 700 years ago. That would be permitted. Right? Which is one of the strangest lines. Because how he knew that this was possible, I don't know. But it's there. Samach Zayin Amud Beis in Sanhedrin. I don't know what to tell you. Other sources that people bring up to point to the positives of... let me just take one. Look at the last page. I don't know how this... Last page? No, not the last page. Second to last page. Other midrashim that people point to... Oh, I did put this. On the second to last page, I gave you this Meiri, number 24... Right, Ben Chayim Mechashef Isho Isha Kulan Biskila, right, whoever is a magician, man or woman, is the death penalty, etc. And then he goes on the, right, and he says, at the end of that line, the Kol Maaseh Sheyedim Areyu Bechalak Shafim, anything you do through demons, that's magic. Kol Shu Naaseh Bepula TV, but anything that's done through nature, Einu Bechalak Shafim is not magic. Afil Yadu Livro Briot Yafot Shalomi Zivu Gamin, even if you could create beautiful creatures without procreation, Kemoshin Oda Besifrei HaTeva, as is already known in the science book, Sheina Davar Nimna, that it's not impossible. Rishayim Lasot Shekol Shu TV Einu Bechalak Yishuf, anything which is natural can be done through science is not magic. It's just like we said about any medical issue, anything done through medicine, that it is not magic. Other midrashim that are quoted...
Wait, who says this?
Meiri. This is in source 24, towards the end. Other sources they point at are this conversation number 23. I'll say it outside. Tarnus Rufus and Rabbi Kiva got into an argument. Tarnus Rufus said to Rabbi Kiva, he was a Roman officer, he said to Rabbi Kiva, charity is unethical. Why is charity unethical? Because God made them poor and you are, right? You are trying to thwart God's will. And Rabbi Kiva said, it is not true. Because he gave him a mashal. And he said as follows, right? If a king threw a rebellious servant into prison, he wouldn't really want people to help him. But let's say he threw his child into prison because he had to, he violated a law, and then he found out that someone was helping him. He might be happy, right? Because he had to punish him, but he wanted people to help. But what does that already indicate? There's a lot to say to that in charity. But the point is that Tarnus Rufus thought that anything that the fact that the world is a certain way means you can't change it. What did Bikiva say? No, sometimes God wants you to change it. In another midrash, he says the same thing about Bris Mila, right? Right? He says, look, right? Isn't Bris Mila problematic? Why did God create the world imperfect? And Rabbi Kiva responded, well, what's better, bread or wheat? Right? Bread. Like, I don't understand the problem, right? Sometimes God just wants you to change the world. I don't understand what's the problem, right? This is part of the way the world is, that we create, we change. God wants that. So for every source that you will find that it is problematic to be like God, you'll find other sources that say, no, it's fine, or it's great, we want you to conquer the world. So to summarize what we've seen so far, what issues are going to determine whether using CRISPR for all these, right, improving, right, are good or bad? So he said there are certain halachic issues, potentially, maybe, but most of the issues are meta, right? Now, you could take the approach, Like the Eretz Yisrael, well, if it's not usher, then it's mutter. Or you could be small c, very conservative, and say, no, we don't like new things. More substantively, what you're really looking at is here a nexus between halacha and hashkafa. And there, what you really need to do is ask, well, what are the values that are under discussion? Those values, as we said, are not necessarily binding the way halacha is, but they're also not meaningless, right? They're meaningful. One value is beauty, right? If we're going to be using CRISPR to pursue aesthetic issues, so is that something that's okay? If you think not, then you're going to say it's not worth entering into this moral nightmare. If you say yes, that's perfectly legitimate, then it's fine. Medical issues where we have precedent, both ethically and halakhically, for saying that healing disease is a good thing, so obviously we're going to want to pursue it. Playing God, is that something that you're worried about? So, as we saw, some people think that's not even a value. Right? There's no such thing. Others say, no, it is a problem. Others will contend, no, halakha actually wants you to be creative. That's important, that's good, nothing. Even, right, cloning, which the Meiri is already talking about 700 years ago. That's fine. If you're using science, that's legitimate. Or as the Rav said, that's actually being God, right? That's being godly. That's what we're supposed to be doing, right? If you're the type of person who thinks, look, we don't want you to act like God, then you'll say, right, you're going to want limitations. Poskim who celebrate it are going to say, no, right? The fact that we can do this much is what God wanted. That's why God allowed us to do it, right? But what you see is that these are not just ethical issues. They are, but they're not halakhic either, right? These are debates about meta values within halacha. Now, let me say a few words about some of the unique issues within choosing the sex of the child. I don't think we'll spend another whole shiur unless you dafka want to focus on it. There are certain issues that are unique to that which don't come up in CRISPR that actually make it more problematic. Which, for example... IVF, through IVF specifically, or even IUI a little bit, there are certain problems because in order to choose, right, you have to, right, you have to have ejaculation not in the act of intercourse, what we call an halacha hotzeh, right, well, not necessarily levatala, but not, which is potentially levatala, which is potentially for no reason, and there, certain poskim will say, look, if we think that choosing the sex of your child is not legitimate, then the act of procuring the semen was problematic halachically. Right? Right? Meaning, and therefore Poskim will distinguish. They'll say, look, if the couple can't have children at all, so then you have to procure the semen, and then choosing might be less problematic. But if the couple was fully capable of having children, they have 9 girls, right? They just want a boy. Right? So maybe halacha would just say, look, that's not, right? That's not relevant. Another factor. Poskim will say, well, is it legitimate because of purvu? Well, on the one hand, so that partially comes down to how do you understand the obligation to have a boy and a girl? Right? If you understand that it's an obligation to have a boy and a girl, then maybe you'd say, well, this is legitimate. If you say, no, the obligation is to have children, and once you've had a boy and a girl, you don't have to try anymore. But, right, it's the act of trying that's the mitzvah, then maybe this is not the type of thing that you actually have to, right, that you're actually obligated to try. Yeah?
I just think it's so weird that the obligation...
Good, that's another perspective on it. Correct. So that's actually part of the discussion as well, right? The extent to which, I mean, halacha does take it on the individuals, but there is a universal element to it, and how that plays out in this particular context is complicated. I mean, that it definitely is, right? I mean, the fact that exists is definitely true. There are other questions. Are you yotzei puruvu with it? I don't want to get into those for now, unless you want to have all share on it, but you could tell me, but I gave you all the sources so you could look at it. What I think is very good from that conversation is the following. In that conversation, you also had Poskim. You had Poskim who said, look, never do anything to try to choose the sex of your child. You're playing God, right? Like, that's just a problem. Like Rav Neuwirth said that. You have other Poskim who say, nah, it's not a problem. This playing God thing doesn't bother me. You have post-Gum who say, look, the natural ways are fine, maybe even the Erickson method, but IVF is a problem unless you have really extenuating circumstances like medical reasons. Right? You find the whole range, and I gave you a summary on... Yeah, I gave you a summary in 29. I literally just gave you in English a summary of the range of post-Gum. So you can see how they all play out the same way. Those who oppose, those who support, those who are right hesitant, those who only do it for medical issues, those who recognize the legitimacy of wanting a boy and a girl, some who will only want it after four, right? If you have four of the same sex or five, whatever, etc. What I think was most interesting in that in conversation was an article by Rav Shurlo. Rav Shurlo wrote an article and he said, look, he was asked to help weigh in on the policy for the Israeli government on choosing the sex of the child. And he said, look, in the end of the day, I think that most of this discussion is not about halacha, it's about slippery slope. Right? And he said, look, halacha may not weigh on this issue directly, but halacha has a heck of a lot to say about how we construct Gzerot. Meaning, if call a spade, if you don't think it's a problem for a specific person to choose the sex of their child because they have a legitimate reason, or CRISPR, right, for the same purpose, right, you don't think that this CRISPR, right, this procedure for this person is a problem, but you're worried about where it'll lead, then what you're asking is not a localized value question. What you're asking is, how do you construct safeguards to prevent this slippery slope? And he said, halacha has a lot to say about that. Yeah. Correct.
So, like, I feel like for the sex of a child, it's like...
No, that there's something you're worried about, not a value everyone's seeking towards, that there's a result that everyone's afraid of.
No, but the thing that people would be afraid of is that everybody would want this certain result.
Like, well, no, the result isn't the sex of the child. The result is that we're worried that we don't reach eugenics, right? We don't reach a society where everyone is picking one sex or something like that.
Right.
Right. Or that we're worried that choosing the sex of the child will lead to eugenics, right? That this will just be the beginning once people get used to choosing. Now, when I was talking to Roger Chiner about this, he said the reason he thinks that there's less discussion about slippery slope in CRISPR is because some of the things people are talking about CRISPR was the end of the slippery slope. Right, I mean, right. CRISPR. Some of the things are actually the slippery slope already. Right, when choosing the sex of the child, we were worried that maybe it'll one day be that you can choose, you know, eye color. We're at the point where you probably could do that. I don't think that's actually true. I think that if you listen to the ethical conversations going among scientists, we're still in slippery slope territory. We haven't yet gotten to the point where CRISPR has been used for that. The question is, what limitations should we put on legitimate uses of CRISPR, knowing what could happen? So I'm not sure that's a fair critique. But in the 10 minutes we have, let me just tell you what Rav Shurlo said, because I thought it was brilliant. Rav Shurlo said that if you look at the halachic system, and you want... Why is there no eraser? Okay. Rav Shurlo said, look... What? It's usually spelled in English either C-H or S-H-E-R-L-O-W. In Hebrew, it's a Shin Reish Lamed Vav. But I gave you the summary of it later on. He said, look, he said halacha has basically three principles that it uses to construct slippery slope-based prohibitions. What he calls in Hebrew, sikui, sikun, and mechir. Or in English, chance, danger, and cost. But let me explain what that means. He said, look, in halacha, we only prohibit things because of the slippery slope if, one, the likelihood of the undesired result is high. Right? How does he know that halacha cares about this? Because of a principle known as milta de lo shchicha lo gazru be rabbanan. Things that are uncommon, Chazal don't bother making zerot about, which tells you that the first thing they take into concern is how likely is that bad result to happen. If it's unlikely, then we don't prohibit a lot of things that are otherwise good, right? Because it might lead to something in a rare circumstance, which is bad, right? So that's factor one. Factor two is how bad would it be if that slippery slope ended up being true, right? Meaning, okay, How bad, right? If the... Right, we all have certain sort of safeguards we put, right? If we're on a diet, the best thing we know to do is not to stock our house with junk food, right? But some of us will stock our house with junk food anyways, even when we're on a diet, so that we can have it on Shabbos, and we'll say, what's the worst that'll happen? Is that we'll break our diet. Okay, so we'll go on the diet next week, right? It's not the biggest deal, right? If the end result is eugenics, right, then we're like, you know what? It might be worth putting some safeguards. And he said, how do I know halacha thinks in the same way? Because of two principles. One is, ein gozrin gzeira l'gzeira. We set up decrees to protect biblical law, but not to protect the rabbinic law that are protecting the biblical law. Because we think it's worth safeguarding really, really, really strict things, but not less strict things. However, when it comes to things which are have karet or avodah zarah, we'll put multiple safeguards on it, even right, multiple levels of safeguards. So he said the second principle you learn from halacha is that we weigh. How bad would it be if the dreaded result happens? If it's really bad, then it's legitimate to prohibit things that are otherwise neutral if the end result is really bad. So you have to ask the question, how bad would it be? And the third, he said, is that we know that rabbinic laws are often waived in cases of, let's say, extreme monetary loss or lack of human dignity, right? Kavod HaBriyot. Which tells you that the third factor is mechir. Even if there's a legitimate concern of what might happen, what would be the cost to our life in the here and now if, because of the fear of what might happen, we prohibited something that objectively is adds to our quality of life now? Right? He said those are the three factors. And therefore he said a halachically informed, well, be careful, a halachically informed policy is going to be one that is honest about how, right, figures out how bad would the potential results be of, right? How likely are those results to happen? And what is the cost of prohibiting things that we think are fundamentally good, right? We all agree that, like, CRISPR can do good things. But how bad are the results we're worried about? How likely are they to happen? And is it worth the cost? Is the risk worth the cost, right? To give up on the potential, let's say, life-saving procedures, right? That's going to be a halakhically informed policy. Is one that takes all the values we've been talking it and plugs it in to the this type of an equation. Again, that's not the same as a halakhic argument. It's a halakhically informed values discussion. And the way he frames it by, right, the choosing the sex of the child, I think is very helpful in CRISPR as well. Is that really, that's what we need to do. Right, the first half of this year, we sort of went through the potential values. The second thing we got to figure out is how likely is this technology to be misused? How bad would it be if it was misused? And are we willing to swallow that risk, knowing the potential good that this technology can do? Right, that's the type of discussion that we need to have in halacha. To end, let me just show you, and this is the last source on the page. Israeli law actually came up with a policy that tries to balance this when it came to choosing sex of the child, to just model what it might look like to take these types of concerns and model a policy which is values informed. And like I said, the world is essentially trying to do that now with CRISPR as well. And I said, when it came to, let's say, choosing the sex of the child, you had two opposite extremes, right? You had America who said everything goes because, right, there are no limitations, and Canada who said we're too scared of the results, everything's prohibited. But there is a possibility in the middle, and this is what I think the world is trying to get through with CRISPR, which is recognize the dangers, put controls in place, but not put a full stop on this technology because it is so valuable. And if you just want to see, again, what this would look like, or might look like to do that. So if you look at the last source, this was an article by Gila Leiter, which she called What Israeli Policy Can Teach Us About Elective Sex Selection. She wrote as follows. Israel has a unique approach to the question. Israel is known for its high rates of IVF with the highest rates of intervention per capita in the world. PGD is regulated by the Ministry of Health since 2005, based not on legislation, but mandated by directive, and sex selection for non-medical reasons is basically prohibited. Exceptions can be made in rare cases after written permission is granted by the committee, appointed by the Director General of the Ministry of Health and composed of 7 members, including a psychologist, physicians in OBGYN and genetics, a medical ethicist, social worker, lawyer, and clergyman. Couples singles and single women can apply if they feel there would be significant damage to the family's member's mental health if the procedure was not done. The applicant should be married, should have four joint children of the same sex and none of the other, etc. What Israel basically came up with is a recognition that we should permit it, but make sure that you're having the ethical conversations before you engage in this type of technology. And that type of model might work in terms of CRISPR, where we recognize its dangers, we recognize the values involved, but we don't allow that to dictate it. We allow it rather to help us construct a ethically, halakhically informed policy. So I think that's basically the direction that is going to be productive in terms of thinking about CRISPR, is one, recognizing this not halakhic, but it is values, and values are important, identifying the values and the complexity within them, and then realizing that really what we're asking is not just what are the values, but how does halakha integrate those values and the recognition of both the benefits and dangers into a slippery slope argument. And there, as Rishulah notes, halakha actually has a lot to say about the types of calculations we make to make responsible policy decisions, and taking that together would help us sort of construct a halakhically informed, responsible policy that both recognizes the potential in CRISPR and the dangers. And I think, essentially, if you look at the ethical community, they're trying to do similar things, but I think halakha might have some room in similarly shedding light on that type of discussion. Yeah? Oh, yeah, that's the article. That's the last source. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, it's the last article, but Google later. If you Google it,
the whole article is actually interesting because it's a discussion of how do you make policies around issues like this. Okay, so those are basically my thoughts on CRISPR cloning. I think at this point it's not worth on giving a share just on choosing the sex of the child. I put all the sources here on the three topics, cloning and CRISPR and whatever, so that you can look them over as you want. But I think just sort of from a methodological perspective, this is actually a good example of modeling the way halakha deals with things that are completely new, that don't necessarily have firm halakhic questions involved, but clearly do have values questions that halakha can inform how you construct policies that are, again, true to the halakhic system, if not formal, formally halakhic in the classic sense. It was the last one. The very last one. Gila Leiter's article. Okay?